4. Close by his ear, a polite but authoritative voice said, "Do you need assistance?" Parsons said, "No, except," he glanced up from his work for a moment. Into the girl's chest, he had plugged a Dixon pump. It had taken over temporarily the job of her uneven heart. Beside him stood a man wearing a nondescript white robe without emblem. Like the others, he was in his 20s. But his voice and manner were not the same, and in his hand he held a flat, black-bordered card. "Keep the people back," Parsons said, and resumed work. The throb of the robot pump gave him confidence. It had been inserted very well, and the load had left the girl's circulatory system. Over her lacerated right shoulder, he sprayed art derm. It sealed off the open wound, halted bleeding, and prohibited infection. The most serious damage was to her windpipe. He turned the little art derm nozzle on an exposed section of rib, wondering what the Shupos had that worked so well. It had carved her open expertly, whatever it was. Now he turned his attention to her windpipe. Beside him, the polite official put away his identification card and said, "Are you certain you know what you're doing?" He had at least cleared away the people. Evidently, his rank affected them. The lobby had become empty. "Maybe we should call the building Euthanor." "The hell with him," Parsons thought. "I'm doing fine," he said aloud. His fingers flew, twisting, cutting, spraying, breaking open plastic tubes of tissue graft, fitting them into place. "Yes," the official said. "I can see. You're an expert. By the way, my name's Al Stenog." At least, Parsons thought, a man with a last name. "This furrow," Parsons said, tracing the line that crossed the girl's stomach. He had coated it with airproof plastic. "It looks bad, but it's merely into the fatty wall, not the abdominal cavity." He showed Stenog the damaged windpipe. "That's the worst." "I think I see the building Euthanor," Stenog said in an affable voice. "Yes, somebody must have called him. Do you want him to assist you?" "No," Parsons said. "It's your decision," Stenog said. "I won't interfere." He was staring at Parsons with curiosity. "My speech," Parsons thought. But he could not worry about that now. At least he had altered the color of his skin. "My eyes," he realized suddenly. As Wade said, "unpigmented." "I have to save this girl's life," he decided. "That's first." With the official watching over his shoulder, he continued his job of healing the girl. "I failed to catch your name," Stenog said unobtrusively. "Parsons," he answered. "That's an odd name," Stenog said. "What does it mean?" "Nothing," Parsons said.
"Oh?"
Stenog murmured. He was silent then for a time as Parsons worked.
"Interesting," he said at last.
A second shape appeared beside Stenog. Parsons, taking a moment to glance up, saw a carefully groomed, handsome man with something under his arm, a kid of some kind, the Euthanor. "It's all over," Parsons said. "I took care of her." "I'm a little late," the Euthanor admitted. "I was out of the building." His eyes strayed as he took in the sight of the girl. "Did this occur here, in the hotel?" Stenog said.
"No, Parsons brought her in from the street."
To Parsons, he said in his smooth voice,
"A vehicle accident? Or an assault? You neglected to say."
Parsons simply didn't answer. He concentrated on the final portion of the job. The girl would live. In another half minute, her life would have ebbed out of her throat and chest, and then nothing would have saved her. His skill, his knowledge, had saved her life. And these two men, evidently respected individuals in this society, were witnesses to it.
"I can't follow your work," the Euthanor admitted. "I've never seen anything like it. Who are you? Where did you come from? How did you learn techniques like that?"
To Stenog, he said,
"I'm completely baffled. I don't recognize any of his accessories."
"Perhaps Parsons will tell us," Stenog said softly. "Of course, this is hardly the time. A little later, no doubt." "Does it matter," Parsons said, "where I come from or who I am?" Stenog said,
I've been informed that there's police action going on around the corner. This girl might be from that event, possibly. You were passing nearby, found the girl injured on the street, brought her... His voice trailed off questioningly, but Parsons said nothing. Now Ikaro was beginning to regain consciousness. She gave a faint cry and moved her arms. There was a moment of stunned silence.
What does this mean? The Euthanor demanded.
I've been successful, Parsons said irritably. Better get her into a bed. There's damage that'll have to heal over a period of weeks.
What did they expect, a miracle?
But there's no longer any danger.
No longer any danger? Stenog repeated.
That's right, Parsons said. What was the matter with them?
She'll recover, understand?
In a slow, cautious voice, Stenog said,
Then in what sense have you been successful?
Parsons stared at him, and Stenog stared back with a faintly contemptuous expression. Examining the girl, the Euthanor began to tremble.
I understand, he said in a choked voice. You pervert! You maniac!
As if he were enjoying the situation, Stenog said in a pleasant, light voice, Parsons, you've blatantly healed the girl. Isn't that a fact? These are therapeutic devices you have here.
I'm amazed.
He seemed almost to laugh.
Well, of course you're under arrest. You realize that.
With firmness, he moved the furious-faced Euthanor back.
I'll handle this, he said. This is my business, not yours. You can go. If you're needed as a witness, my office will get in touch with you.
As the Euthanor reluctantly left, Parsons found himself facing Stenog alone. Leisurely, Stenog brought forth what looked to Parsons like an egg beater. Touching a raised spot on its handle, Stenog sent the blades into spinning motion. The blades disappeared, and from it came a high-pitched whine. Obviously, it was a weapon.
You're under arrest, Stenog said, for a major crime against the United Tribes, the Folk.
The words had a formal sound, but not the man's tone. He spoke them as if they had no importance to him. It was a mere ritual.
Follow me, if you will,
Parsons said. You're serious? The younger man raised a dark eyebrow. He motioned with the egg beater. He was serious.
You are lucky, he said to Parsons, as they moved toward the entrance of the hotel. If you had healed her there with those tribe people.
Again, he eyed Parsons with curiosity.
They would have torn you apart.
But of course, you knew that. This society is insane, Parsons thought. This man and this society together. I am really afraid. In the dimly lighted room, the two shapes watched the glowing procession of words avidly, leaning forward in their chairs, powerful bodies taut.
Too late, the strong-faced man cursed bitterly. Everything was out of phase, no accurate junction with the dredge, and now he's trapped in an intertribal area.
Pressing a control, he speeded up the flow of words.
And now someone from the government.
What's the matter with the emergency team? The woman beside him whispered. Why aren't they there? They could have got him on the street. The first flash was sent out as soon as...
It takes time.
The strong-faced man paced restlessly back and forth, feet lost in the thick carpets that covered the floor.
If only we could have come out in the open.
They won't get there soon enough.
The seated woman struck out savagely, and the flow of illuminated words faded.
By the time they get there, he'll be dead, or worse. So far, we've completely failed, Helmar. It's gone wrong.
Noise, lights, and movement around him. For an instant, he opened his eyes. A shattering blaze of white poured remorselessly down on him from all sides. Once more, he shut his eyes. It hadn't changed.
Your name again? A voice said. Name, please?
He did not answer.
James Parsons, another voice said, a familiar voice.
As he heard it, he wondered dully whose voice it was. He could almost place it. Almost, but not quite.
Old?
32,
the voice said, after a pause. And this time he recognized it.
The voice was his, and he was answering their questions without volition. Off somewhere, machinery hummed. "Born?" the voice asked. Once more, he struggled to open his eyes. His hand came up to shield his eyes from the glare, and he saw, for a moment, the blur of objects and people. A clerk, bored, empty-faced, seated at a recording machine, writing down the answers that were given. A bureaucrat, a functionary in a clean office. No force, no violence. The answers came, however. Why do I tell them?
Chicago, Illinois,
his voice from some other point in the room answered.
Cook County,
the clerk said presently. What month? Date?
October 16th, his voice answered. 1980.
On the clerk's face, the expression remained the same. Brothers or sisters?
No, his voice said.
On and on the questions went, and he answered each one of them.
All right, Mr. Parsons, the clerk said at last.
Dr. Parsons,
the voice, his voice, corrected from a learned reflex. The clerk paid no attention. You're through, he said, removing a spool from the recording machine. Will you go across the hall to room 34, please? With a nod of his chin, he indicated the direction. They'll take care of you there. Stiffly, Parsons rose. A table, he discovered. He had been sitting on a table, and he had on only his shorts, like a hospital, aseptic, white, professional-looking. He began to walk, and as he did so, he saw his white legs unsprayed, a strange contrast to his dyed arms, chest, back, and neck. So they know, he thought, but he kept on walking. In him, there was no desire either to comply or to resist. He simply walked from the interrogation room, down a well-lit hall to room 34. The door opened as he approached. Now he found himself standing in what appeared to be a personal apartment. He saw with amazement a harpsichord, cushions upon a window seat, a window that overlooked the city. Midday by the looks of the sun, books here and there, and on the wall, a reproduction of a Picasso. While he stood there, Stenog appeared, leafing through a clipboard of papers. Glancing at Parsons, he said, Even the deformed? The congenitally deformed? You healed them, too?
Sure, Parsons said.
Now some sense of control had begun to filter back into him.
He began haltingly, but Stenog broke in.
I have read about your period on the history tapes, Stenog said. You're a doctor.
Well, that term is clear. I understand the function you performed, but I can't grasp the ideology behind it.
Why?
His face became animated with emotion.
That girl, Ikora, she was dying, and yet you deliberately made skillful alterations to her system for the purpose of keeping her alive.
Parsons answered with an effort.
That's right.
Now he saw that several other persons had accompanied Stenog into the room. They hung back, out of the way, letting Stenog do the talking.
In your culture, this had a positive value, Stenog said.
Such an act was officially sanctioned?
A person in the background said,
Your profession was honored? A valued social role with plaudits?
Stenog said, I find it impossible to believe a whole society could have been oriented around such behavior. Surely it was a splinter group that sanctioned you. Parsons heard them, but their words made no sense. Everything was out of focus, distorted, as if turned out by some warped mirror.
Healing was respected, he managed to say, but you people seem to think it's somehow wrong.
A furious rustle leaped through the circle of listeners.
Wrong, Stenog snapped. It's madness. Don't you see what would happen if everybody were healed? All the sick and injured? The old?
No wonder his society collapsed, a harsh-eyed girl said. It's amazing it stood so long, based on such a perverted system of values.
It demonstrates, Stenog said thoughtfully, the almost infinite variety of cultural formations. That a whole society could exist oriented around such drives seems to us beyond belief.
but from our historical reconstruction, we know such a thing actually went on. This man here is not an escaped lunatic. In his own time, he was a valued person. His profession had not only sanction, it gave him prestige.
The girl said, "Intellectually, I can accept it, but not emotionally."
A cunning expression appeared on Stenog's face.
"Persons, let me ask you this. I recall a pertinent fact. Your science was also devoted to keeping new life from appearing. You had contraceptives, chemical and mechanical agents, preventing zygote formation within the oviduct."
Parsons started to answer.
"We..." "Rasmort!"
The girl snarled, pale with fury. Parsons blinked. What did that mean? He couldn't convert it into his own semantic system.
"Do you remember the average age of your population?" Stenog asked.
"No," Parsons muttered. "About 40, I believe." At that, the roomful of persons broke into jeers.
40,
Stenog said with disgust.
"Our average age is 15.
It meant nothing to Parsons, except that, as he had already seen, there were few old people. "You consider that something to be proud of?" he said wonderingly. A roar of indignation burst from the circle around him.
"All right," Stenog said, gesturing. "I want you all to leave. You're making it impossible for me to perform my job."
They left reluctantly. When the last had gone, Stenog walked to the window and stood for a moment.
"We had no idea," he said at last to Parsons over his shoulder.
"When I brought you in here, it was for a routine examination." He paused. "Why didn't you dye your body all over? Why just in parts?"
Parsons said, "No time."
"You've just been here briefly." Stenog glanced over the written material on his clipboard. "I see that you claim no knowledge of how you got from your time segment to ours. Interesting." If it was all there, there was no point in him saying anything. He remained silent. Past Stenog, he could see the city, and he began to take an interest in it, the spires.
"What bothers me," Stenog said, "is that we dropped experimentation with time travel something like 8 years ago. The government, I mean. A principle was put forth, showing that time travel was a limited application of perpetual motion and hence a contradiction of its own working laws. That is, if you wanted to invent a time machine, all you'd have to do was swear or prophesy that when you got it working, the first use you'd put it to would be to go back in time to the point at which you got interested in the idea."
He smiled.
"And give your earlier self the functioning, finished piece of equipment. This has never happened. Evidently, there can be no time travel. By definition, time travel is a discovery that, if it could be made, would already have been made. Perhaps I oversimplified the proof, but substantially..."
Parsons interrupted. "That assumes that if the discovery had already been made, it would be publicly known, recognized. But nobody saw me leave my own world." He gestured. "And do you think they realize now what's happened? All they know is that I disappeared with no trace. Would they infer that I was carried into time?" He thought of his wife. "They don't know," he said. "There was no warning." Now he told Stenog the details. The younger man listened attentively. "A force field," Stenog said presently. With a sudden shudder of anger, he said, "We shouldn't have given up experimentation. We had a good deal of basic research done, hardware constructed." Now he pondered. "That hardware, God knows what became of it. The research never was kept secret. Presumably the hardware was sold off. A lot of valuable components were involved. That was last year or so. We had it so clearly in mind that time travel would show up in some vast historic way, interfere with the collapse of the Greek city-states, assist the success of Napoleon's European plan, and thereby obviate the following wars. But you're implying a secret, limited time travel. For some personal reasons. Not official. Not for social aims." His boyish face drew into a troubled scowl.
"If you recognize that I'm from another time,"
Parsons said. From another culture. How can you convict me for what I did?
To that, Stenog nodded.
You had no knowledge, of course. But our law has no clause about persons from another culture. There is no other culture, no diversity, whatever. Ignorant or not, you have to stand trial for sentence. There's a historic concept. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. And isn't that what you're claiming?
The patent injustice of it staggered Parsons.
Yet he could not tell from Stenog's tone just how serious the man was. The faintly detached, ironical quality could not be interpreted. Was Stenog mocking himself? Parsons said stiffly, "Can't you use your reason?" Chewing his lip, Stenog said, "You have to abide by the laws of the community in which you live, whether you came voluntarily or not." But
he now appeared to be genuinely concerned. The irony had gone.
"Possibly some suspension can be worked out. The motions could be gone through."
Going from the room, he left Parsons alone for a time. When he returned, he carried a polished oak box with a lock on it. Seating himself, he produced a key from his robe and unlocked the box. Out of it, he lifted a massive white wig. With solemnity, he placed the wig on his head. At once, with his dark hair concealed, and the heavy rolls of the wig outlining his face, he lost the appearance of youth. A gravity and importance entered his appearance. Stenog said, "As director of the fountain, I have the authority to pass judgment on you." From beneath his peruke, he scrutinized Parsons. "What we mainly have to consider is the formal procedure of exile."
"Exile?" Parsons echoed.
"We don't maintain our prison colonies here. I forget what system your culture employed. Work camps, CCC in Soviet Asia?" After a pause, Parsons managed to say, "By my time, the CCC camps were gone. So were the slave labor camps in Russia."
"We make no attempt to rehabilitate the criminal," Stenog said. "That would be an invasion of his rights. And, from a practical standpoint, it doesn't work. We don't want substandard persons in our society."
"The Shupos," Parsons said with dread. "They're involved in these colonies," Stenog said.
"The Shupos are too valuable to be sent off Earth. A good deal of them are our youth, you understand. Especially the active element. The Shupo organization maintains youth hostels and schools set apart from society, operated in the Spartan manner. The children are trained both in body and in mind. They're hardened. The activity that you saw, the raid on the illegal political group, is incidental, a sort of field expedition. They're quite zealous, the boys from the hostels. On the streets, they have the right, as individuals, to challenge any person they feel is not acting properly."
"What are the prison colonies like?"
"They're city-sized. You'll be free to work, and you'll have a separate dwelling of the apartment type where you can pursue various hobbies or creative crafts. The climate, of course, isn't favorable. Your lifespan will be cut down enormously. Much depends on your own stamina."
"And there's no way I can appeal your decision?" Parsons demanded. "No trial system? The government brings the charges and then acts as the judge? Merely by putting on a medieval periwig?"
"We have the girl's signed complaint," Stenog said.
At that, Parsons stared at him. He could not believe it.
"Oh, yes," Stenog said. "Come along."
Rising, he opened a side door, beckoning Parsons to follow him. Formidable and solemn in his wig, he said,
"Possibly this will tell you more about us than anything you have seen so far."
They passed by door after door. Parsons, in a daze, followed the bewigged younger man, barely able to keep up with his springy step. At last, Stenog halted at a door, unlocked it, and stepped aside for Parsons to enter. On the first of several small stages lay a body, partly covered by a white sheet. Ikora. Parsons walked toward her. Her eyes were shut, and she did not move. Her skin had a faded, washed-out quality.
"She filed the complaint," Stenog said, "just before she died."
He switched on a light, gazing down. Parsons saw that beyond any doubt the girl was dead, possibly had been for several hours.
But she was recovering, he said.
She was getting well.
Reaching down, Stenog lifted the sheet back. Along the side of the girl's neck, Parsons saw a careful, precise slash. The great carotid arteries had been cut, and expertly.
In her complaint, she charged you with deliberately obstructing the natural process of sealmodus, Stenog said. As soon as she had filled out this form, she called her residential euthanor and underwent the final rite.
Then she did it herself, Parsons said.
It was her pleasure. By her own will, she undid the harm you had attempted.
Stenog shut off the light.